Since this will be our last morning group together, session together, I want to make it just as valuable as we possibly can. We're going to do this in two or three different ways. First of all, we're going to summarize everything that we have covered up to now, and perhaps add some emphasis on certain points. But we're going to start from the very beginning, way on back to man's condition, and work our way up to where we are not in that condition anymore, just step by step. But during the second half of this morning session, I would like you to, those of you who would like to volunteer at it, to join me in telling the rest of the class out loud, if you would, and you can either write it down sometime between now and when we come back for the second session, either write it down or get it in your mind some way. Would you please formulate in your mind one single thought that has been of value to you in one way or another? You remember, we said it's very valuable to think these things through and then reduce one thought to a single short sentence. So if you will do that, anything that has been of benefit to you that you can mention out loud to the others, you can have more than one if you want, you can have several. Because we're all different, and we will all have different impressions from this. And maybe one that struck you in particular is perhaps about third on the list in someone else's mind. But since they're all equally important, the fact that it impressed and helped you will help the person sitting next to you. And maybe I'll join you informally as they come to my mind on various points. And I'll give you one major example, which is a terrific thought. The thought that simply as follows: there is a way out. If you want positive meditation, you just think about one, two, three, four words: there is a way out. So will you do that when we come back after the break, if you'd like, on a volunteer basis? Speak out some thought, or more than one, but one at a time, obviously, and then we'll discuss it a little bit. The official title of this morning's talk had to do with self-observation, and we have already gone into some preliminary ideas about self-observation, such as being aware when you raise your hand to your head like that, or being aware of a indecision, whether shopping or something in your personal life. And we're doing this for just one major reason, but what a great reason. And that is to become acquainted with ourselves as we actually are, instead of as we have assumed we are, because we have all these images and preferences and self-flatteries and wrong ideas about ourselves. It can be illustrated as follows. If I have been told by a lawyer that I've inherited a mansion out in the country, it's now mine, and he warns me, he says it's a fine house, it's solid, and there's many rooms to it, but it has a reputation of being a haunted house. And if I am young and gullible and believe in ghosts, and it has the reputation of being a haunted house, I will begin to wonder about it and be frightened about it. But if I want badly enough to take possession of this house, to inherit it in fact, instead of on a piece of lawyer's paper, then I have to go out to the house and take possession of it. So I go out there and see. I am sure you get the connection of what we're getting into here. I cannot go out into the house into the day. I always have to go out at night, because this is the way in the psychological country we are. We are in nighttime all the time. So I can't say I'll wait till morning. I have to go out right in the full terror of it being at night. So I go out to the house all alone, by the way. You can't go with me. It's my inheritance, and you couldn't go with me if you wanted. There's nothing for you there, and I have to dare it all alone. I can't take you along for company or comfort. So I go out there, and I have a lamp of some kind, and always, of course, in fear and trembling, I open the front door. I'm sure if it was a movie, the door would squeak. But I take a look at the first room, and I'm shaking, all right, and I'm all alone. But I see that, as a matter of fact, by the light of my own light that I am carrying myself and not depending on the power company who's got wires in there, because there's no wires, it's all what I carry myself in my own hand. And I see that there are no ghosts in the front room, the big living room, and I get a little more courage to go on to another room back there, and I see there are no ghosts there, and finally I'm able to go upstairs. And finally I get the final, because see, I'm getting stronger all the time because I'm beginning to disbelieve in what I've been told about my inheritance, about, which is about myself. Finally, I have the courage to do the most frightening thing of all, and you'll get the connection here, to go down into the cellar. Because that's where the dungeons are and where the ghosts hide out at night, I suppose. So I go down in there and I finally clean out the whole thing by one process alone. I don't fight ghosts. You can't fight an illusion. You can try, but you're not really fighting an illusion. I go down and I see that there's nothing to fight. After all, that the ghosts were in my misinformed mind, what I took as true, and I find out that it was false after all. But I have to go through it. I have to do it. Then it becomes my possession. In fact, then it is daylight from then on. That is the process as an illustration. Now we're going to do the very same thing in a little different way by going step by step as to how an individual finds this way out. Step by step. With every individual, it will vary a little bit. A human being is born into this world with a defect in his system. And from the day of his birth, this defect is pounced upon by his parents, by his brothers and sisters, by society as a whole, by everyone he meets, by his school teachers who teach him how to read and write in one way or another. Because he's seeing that school teacher's expression. He's watching how she behaves. And so on. All the other people in his life. So he grows up with this defect, which is then made worse by everyone around him. He is given false values. He's given false ambitions. He is given, most of all, a wrong identity about who he is. He is told that he must fight his way in life financially. This is a dog-eat-dog world. You have to fight for your rights. Don't let people walk all over you. All this is building up a hard, hard center in him. And this is a terrible thing. You can see it in children. I was in a drugstore in Los Angeles a while back and in a certain little line situation, and there was a young lady who, I won't go into details, but racially speaking, and she looked up at me in a very hard look on her face. And I could see what had happened in her home, what had happened in her conditioning, where now she had enemies, which you probably never ever break away from. So we get all these false ideas which begin to harden us. Then this hardness, this center, becomes what I call me, myself. Then my neighbor, who has also been subjected to these falsehoods, which are taken as truths because we just don't know any better, and there's no way we can know. We have never run into anyone who has the slightest idea that there's another way to live. They give us religious principles, and they give us little Sunday school ideas, but we sense that they are not living those ideas. We know it. So I have this hard center, and with this hard center, I begin to meet the world. Now I begin to be in pain and in conflict and in suffering of every kind, and my human relations are already a mess, even when I'm quite young. Because I think that I am separate from you, I am I, and you are you. I am now many things. I am your enemy, you are mine, competitor, someone to win over. And even when I call you my friend, I sense there's something wrong with it. Because if I am depending upon you and you're depending upon me, we have a wrong relationship. Because we are both hardened, our so-called friendship or marriage consists merely of two frightened people who say, thank heaven I have an ally, someone who is on my side. But having taken two people on the same side, it's now two against the world. And we haven't found a friend at all. We've simply found an ally in our warfare, which means the warfare is still going on. Out of many, many tens of thousands of human beings who find themselves in this conditioned state, in this suffering, in this terrible confusion, not knowing what to do, a few people reach the point in their lives where they don't want to go on this way anymore. The crisis is too painful, it's too horrible to endure. So these individuals start to look around, search around for something else. And the minute they do, it gets worse. Because wherever they turn, they run into more confusion. And they think they have found, examples, the right psychiatrist, the right psychologist, the right religious counselor or minister, the right therapy group, the right book, and on and on and on. And so this confused person, but who wants to get out, I think perhaps some of you have experienced this. You go from one group and one teacher and one lecture to another, and every once in a while you get real high hopes about it, because for one thing, everybody in the auditorium of 200 people is all excited, and they're smiling and cheery and happy, and they all pay attention to the speaker, who is very dynamic, maybe he's very dynamic and he has a high reputation. And you meet someone who's very friendly, you happen to accidentally sit next to him in the group, and you get real excited, and deep down inside you sense even the excitement is false. If you are real honest. So we keep looking around for many, many years, maybe. And all the time, the crisis, instead of getting better, which we thought it would if we left that church or that psychiatrist, it gets worse. But because we have remained intensely honest, to the degree that we're able to at this point, intensely sincere, we refuse to settle with this group or that book or whatever. Then we begin to see at this point a very interesting thing happening to us. And it's so vague. Remember, we've illustrated it as the light that we see for the first time. Then it goes out. We wonder whether we saw it or not at all, whether we were deceiving ourselves. But we really sense something rather than know it. And then at this point, and I really can't describe it. Maybe some of you can describe it to yourself, but I can't. I can tell you about it, but I can't do any more than that. At this point, something starts to fall away inside. And this is the first falling away of one little, I wish I had an illustration, one of the outer layers of all this excessive clothing that we've been wearing that we don't need, but we thought it was necessary. One of them falls away. And it becomes a feeling as well as a thought. But we still stumble. And we may go back to something we gave up 10 years ago. But when this first little experience happens of something falling away, it has now made a vacant place for something that for the first time in our life we sense and feel is very real. Now if we stick with it, the battle is furious, but you have won. If you will stick with it, you have won. You have to stick with it. And to stick with it means to have courage to now more consciously, deliberately drop all false ideas that we have acquired over the years. And every time you drop a false idea, a heavy overcoat, you do it in fear and trembling. But now you know, because you have done it once, you can do it twice, and you can do it three times, and you can do it four times. The individual who persists with his pain without running away from it will eventually reach this point. And you're following me, I know you are, or you wouldn't have come back to this class. So certain individuals who want out persist in this falling down 10,000 times. That's nothing. Fall down 50,000 times. It makes no difference. Just get up and go back to it again. And then so many things happen, they can't be described. But from now on, when you hear advice immediately, there is a perception of whether that advice is true or false. Then you will do, as many people do, they go into their little private library where all these books are stored, and they're able to go right down the top row and the second row, and out of every 20 books, 19 of them are tossed out forever. And that one, at the time we bought that book, we bought it really accidentally. It just happened. We liked the cover of it or something like that, and we read it. Okay, great. And then we read another that was not a truthful book, but we still didn't know the difference. The time comes when we can see exactly. Because we are right. We are now getting right in ourselves. Then your whole life changes in many, many ways, the way you want it to. So, if you want out, this is how to do it. All right, let's open it up to questions, comments.
What I was thinking as you were saying that is the time element, and I guess that maybe is not the thing to bring in on this level, but it may take a lifetime for this.
The gentleman asked the question the other night on that same, how long does it take? May I ask that you help yourself by forgetting that part of it? There is, you see, shall I repeat what I said the other night? And not necessarily apply it to you, but deep down inside, people are afraid that they won't have enough time to find themselves before they die. This is an anxiety. There must be no anxiety in your search. You forget the time element, because time will be on the common level. It takes you 3 weeks to weed your garden or whatever you do, and you're thinking in those terms. Look, truth, freedom, consciousness is not in time. If you could do it, you could be in a state of what you want right now. See? We don't do it because the cluster, the hardness is too thick. But we could do it if we could do it. We could drop it right this very second and walk out of this door a new person. So cease to think in terms of time. And you'll save a lot of energy.
Would you comment on desire? Now we have a desire to get out or a way out. The overall word desire, could you just...
As a general comment. All right. First of all, separate desires on the everyday level, which are normal and right. You have a desire for rest and for a home and food and so on. So that is not what we're talking about, but we've cleared that. Any desire that we have that makes us want to be honest with ourselves as a general starting principle that makes us want to get out is a right desire. It's not wrong to want to get out of the trap. But when we have this one major desire, the wish, the longing, the yearning, to get out of ourselves and to be in our right nature, all kind of false desires come in and masquerade as true desires. And again, when we go out and seek help on these things, people who have not found themselves will encourage these for their own benefit, but we won't go into that. Time will come when you'll be able to separate what is a right desire and a false desire. I'll give you, can be very tricky. Now, you have books, all of you have books to read, fine. And we must have the knowledge from books. That is part of our growth, of our understanding. But you're sitting around some night and you're a little anxious. You're working on yourself, see. But you're a little anxious, a little nervous, and you can't make up your mind whether to go out or stay home. You add up the advantages and disadvantages. I have to get dressed. But on the other hand, it might be not. So you're in confusion. So you say, well, the only thing I know what to do about this confusion and anxiety is to read. So you sit down and read the particular book that you're studying, whatever it might be. Now, this can be a false desire because you're doing the easy thing. It is very simple to sit down and read when you're troubled. The hard thing would be to do, and the far better thing would be to set the book aside, sit down in a chair without your coffee and cigarettes and without TV, and just sit there and watch yourself suffer. See? Because you have not distracted yourself from your indecision, from your pain, by reading a book. Because now, the desire to read the book has become a distraction from facing what you feel inside. See, we make ourselves do the thing we don't want to do. And the more you do that, the faster you'll grow. So to wrap up on desire, just look at your state and try to find out what would make you suffer more consciously and do that, which does not mean deliberate self-punishment, which is another thing. It means to simply watch the state you're in and don't do anything to make it vanish, like reading the book. Then at another time it would be proper to read the book, because now at this particular moment you want facts, you want knowledge, which is necessary too.
How do you gain by doing that? By just suffering?
When you don't escape something, you begin to understand it. If I want to understand you, where you live and all that, but I run away from you because I'm afraid of you. If I'm afraid of you, I can't learn about you. So I stay right in your presence, even though your expression on your face frightens me, or the tone of your voice, or you have power over me, and you're the policeman or whatever. I understand you by staying right there. At the same time, I'm watching myself react to you. And then I finally find out. This is amazing, an amazing experience. As example, I'm frightened of this gentleman. I stay and I watch everything. I watch the hardness on your face. You have a badge and you can give me a ticket or take me to jail or whatever. At the same time, I'm watching my fright. I finally see you have no power whatsoever to frighten me. I thought you did, but I didn't. I wasn't watching myself in relation to you. I finally see what is frightening me is me. When I see this, and I see it by not escaping, by sticking with my suffering of being afraid of you, I see it, and it vanishes. Then you can be as powerful as you want, the head of the Gestapo, and I'm not afraid of you anymore, because I saw where it was. I thought it was in you. It wasn't in you at all. But I was confused, and I made an opposite of me. I made you as an opposite. Remember we're talking about that? Someone had their hand up.
Well, I don't know if this thought is relevant or not, but I had it when she asked about time, and you said it was creating an anxiety.
Right.
This thought occurred to me. Also, if you accept the idea that this is tremendously difficult, you're also creating an anxiety, aren't you?
Yes, if you take it in the wrong way. What we're trying to do is abolish any form of self-deception as follows. If I read a positive thought and wander around muttering that to myself all day long, that this is self-work, see? That's simply the mechanical part of my mind, which is the lazy part of the mind, thinking that it's working. The reason I mention that it is difficult, not to discourage anyone, but to avoid self-deception, to think that we've already got it made. See? And then do you also recall, and I'm quite aware of all this, I'm well aware if I say it's difficult, it might be discouraging, but you have to say this to avoid self-deception. Now, but to offset this, to keep things in balance, you remember I said last night, this is an awful lot of fun? See, so that canceled out a wrong interpretation of the fact that it's hard work.
It's actually fascinating when you start working on this.
Pardon?
It's fun, but it's absolutely fascinating when you start working on this.
Fascinating is a good word. When you want to learn something that's enjoyable, if you want to learn to play the piano, and you love the piano, and you know nothing, and you start, it may be work, but it's not work. It's fun. You enjoy it. And this is exactly what this work is all about. Blundering, getting up, seeing how foolish we were, how we talked mechanically to someone and thought we impressed him. We found out that we didn't impress him at all, that we were trying to make an impression. So we become, this is just a little thing. It's these little things that wake us up.
Could you talk a little bit more about working from the proper center?
Proper center. We can review it briefly. Essentially, we are one unified person. But these persons, just like an automobile, is made up of many parts. And the parts are made up of parts. The mind has a mechanical way of working. The mind has memory. The mind has curiosity, and so on. When we understand the mind correctly, how it operates, then the mind, which is in charge of itself, the conscious mind, then everything underneath this consciousness, conscious mind, falls into place properly and doesn't get mixed up as it goes down the scale. And last night, I believe it was, we had the illustration of if I have a flat tire in my car and go out there, I have to fix that tire, replace the tire with my mind, not with my emotions. I'd be using my emotions and using the wrong center by getting angry that I have a flat tire because it'll get my suit dirty now. So I'm operating emotionally when I should be operating from my mind, intellectually, if you want to use that word. Try to be aware at the moment of what center is the proper one to use. We had the example that music, if you're listening to music, should be listened to with your emotions. How can you listen to music with your mind? That would be very cold, wouldn't it? No matter what their attitude is toward you, regardless of how clear or unclear they may be in their life, you will have the right thought and the right emotions toward them. And not only that, but you will have the right physical attitude toward them, which means this. As you start to grow and understand all these things, including the proper working of centers, your physical body will not do what it used to do in many ways. It won't, for example, if an alcoholic was to start to get on these, he'd really get on to it, and not simply switch to another image. He would not take his physical body down to the bar anymore. Everything changes. But first we have to study, then we see, then it's natural, quite natural.
If you want to do this now on an organized basis, you know, like reducing to writing, I mentioned the other evening about writing down all the false labels, and you said this is good, but don't get tricked, you know, by gloating over them, of course, once you've done it.
Right.
But if you were to do it in an organized manner like that, what would be your steps? Say if you didn't let these false labels, you know, impress you, and you did write them down, then what would be the next step and thereafter? I like to do things in that sort of a fashion.
This is the beauty of it. The beauty of it. We said it's fun, it is also beautiful. At 12:30, I'm going to leave here and I'll go to a cafe, restroom somewhere. I'm sitting down there and had lunch. And at the end of lunch, the waitress comes over and it's time to pay the bill and give her a tip. And I'm sitting with someone, I'm eating with someone else. And something comes up about the tip. Someone asks, do you get 10%? Well, how do you manage it? And I say, now this is false personality talking, and I say something like this, well, I believe in being generous, tipping quite generously. That poor girl works hard for a living. I'm going to leave her 75 cents. This is false personality talking. This is a label talking. You understand? I'm telling you all kind of things about the kind of a person I am. I've just told you that I am generous, that I am sympathetic toward poor waitresses, I understand them, that I have no resentment over giving a tip on top of the $8, $5 bill, that this is just a casual thing to me. I'm a big spender. If that's a woman, I'll probably try to impress her, you know. All right, so far, all right? I am working on myself. So when I go into that restaurant and have the dinner, and I'm going to eat consciously, by the way, not mechanically, at the end of the meal, I'm observing myself all the time. And the girl comes, I'm asked the question about the tip. The situation comes up, the same thing. Now, because I'm working, and I don't want to be a little hypocrite anymore, because I see that hypocrisy is self-division, self-contradiction, and it's painful. It's terrible to impress people. I'm beginning to see that I must go against this mechanical habit, this image of being a generous person, because I really resent it. I didn't want to give her a dollar. I wanted to give her maybe 50 cents or maybe nothing at all, but that's beside the point. I didn't want to give her a dollar. I'm shocked. Because all my life, I've been living from a label of being generous, of being considerate to other people, and I see that it was a complete phony self-label image. You've got to go through this. You've got to do this. The split second I see it quite clearly, that's all I have to do. If I pick up a glass of sour water and taste it, I don't drink any more of that. That's out, because I recognize it as bitter water. But this is just one thing out of a thousand. I think that now I've made great progress. I have made progress, because I don't want to be divided anymore. Now I'm going to think naturally toward this situation, this daily little event of tipping the waitress, and I will do it normally, without conflict, without an image. Not one person in a million will even want to look into this idea, because their images are so intact. And if this was a group of 5,000 people, one man in that back row would get up and say a completely wrong thing, tell him, ask me a question, for example, because his image of being generous is so glued, he felt threatened by what he heard. And you would, most of you would recognize it as a false question, a false remark. I do this every day. Now I've caught that label. I am a generous, helpful kind of person. Now I'm not suffering. I'm not in conflict from it anymore. Then 5 minutes later, I find something else. An hour later, all the time I'm watching myself in operation and refusing to believe that this phony label is me, because it isn't. It's an imposition and it's my pain. One by one, they drop away because I see them as false. And I am not going to live this way anymore. That's out.
I want to clarify, when you see this label as being false, is once you see it clearly, you don't revert back again?
I'll have to comment on that. I gave the ideal situation where if you see it clearly, then it will fall away, which it will, but we don't see it clearly the first time. So we may have to go through a situation like this a dozen times, a 50 times, but that first cracking is wonderful. You try it sometime, and you see what happens. The crack develops, the jar doesn't fall apart yet, but that crack is very real to you. Then you crack it again next time. You'll see it. You'll fall away. I'll give you a work project, among other things. Just what? And you, 20 years from now, and you know what some of you reacted? Well, I'm already 50. I don't think I'll live that long. Yeah, that's right. Just when I mentioned time, this is what people do. But you look back and see this. I'll give you a work project. Sometime today, when you have to reach out for something. It makes no difference what it is. The salt shaker, a book, reach out to pick up, anything at all. I want you, maybe, for the first time in your life, to pick up something consciously instead of mechanically. Instead of reaching over for the salt and shaking it on and continuing a conversation with your wife or husband, you say, I'm going to, for the first time in my life, reach for the salt or whatever consciously. So slow yourself down and put your hand out. You don't necessarily have to close your eyes or anything like that. You be aware of yourself, your hand going out and picking up that salt, and then you shake it on, and then set it down consciously. You think you can do this? You try it. I hope you do it. The point is this. If you do it this once consciously, for the rest of your life, you will remember the first time you ever picked up the salt shaker consciously. This is very valuable. Then it will spread. Well, I must open the door consciously instead of mechanically. Then it will spread to your thoughts. I must talk with this person consciously instead of like a machine like I usually am, always saying the same thing and always being a little nervous. Should I say good morning or whatever? Then eventually you can say good morning consciously and you won't feel you're being mechanical because it's proper to say good morning to people.
I understood you to say that when I eat consciously rather than mechanically. What did you mean by that?
Just what we were talking about. And you won't do it all the time this way, and you must not do it all the time this way, because many things we found out must be mechanical. Some things must be mechanical and should be. That's why you can drive your automobile while talking with someone or listening to the radio, whatever you do, because the mechanical part is working in its proper place. What we're talking about is this. We are in a mechanical state of mind. Now, how are we going to break this mechanicalness? We do it by interrupting it. So instead of reaching mechanically for the salt, I'm going to do it consciously as a work project. And most of the times, I will reach mechanically because that's proper to do that. See, this is the way we're built, so that there other centers that can work while we're doing something else. You can do many things at one time. But if I do it consciously, that breaks the pattern so that I see that it was mechanical. Now I can begin to see the difference between mechanicalness and consciousness. And eventually I'll revert maybe to picking up mechanical. But I'm beginning to see the difference, yes.
Well, what would you say in the difference of eating consciously or mechanically? When you eat, you eat to enjoy your food, and if you're just eating mechanically, you're thinking about other things and doing, and maybe you're carrying on a conversation, and maybe you don't even know what the food tastes like.
That's quite true. That's a good project in itself. Be aware of the taste of your food. That brings the physical center in it, see, as well. Have you ever sat down at a meal and all of a sudden you find out your plate is empty and you wonder what happened? That's because you were eating mechanically. Which most people do.
So there's something wrong with that? I mean, if you're eating just because you have to keep your body alive.
I'm missing the point.
Was there anything wrong with eating mechanically or doing something?
Not if it's proper at that time. I'm saying we're using these, we're interrupting even proper mechanicalness in order to see the difference between mechanicalness and consciousness. It is not wrong to eat mechanically even. If you were doing, it's necessary to do other things. Many centers can be operating at the same time. You can be You can be walking at the same time you're talking, at the same time you're thinking, at the same time you're gesturing. All this is economy. But there'll be no contradiction between all these parts. This is what we're getting at. You can say one thing, but feel another, can you not? This is contradiction. This is division. I say to the girl, oh, I always tip a buck to a waitress. I feel they work hard. I don't feel that at all. I'm in contradiction. Maybe one more, then we'll go downstairs.
I was just going to say that, in other words, when you are conscious of your thoughts, you can also be conscious that your senses are sharper, perhaps. Now that you're perceiving, seeing things, hearing things, smelling things.
Right. Everything becomes quite clear. Remember I said last night, you become a very sharper and wiser shopper in just simple everyday things, shopping for groceries. Everything becomes quite clear. You can, I'll pull an example out very briefly. You can go into a grocery market. Now you're doing something on the everyday level. You have to buy food. That's right. It's mostly mechanical. You prefer this brand of corn instead of that. That's all right. There's no problem there. But when you go into the market, when you're working on yourself, the whole world in there is different. And I'm not getting mystical or dramatic, but it is different. You'll see 10,000 things. For example, you're so alive and so alert. A person will walk by you and you'll see the expression on their face and you know they're asleep, for example. You'll see the manager putting on a display of false personality because his boss from the head office in Oakland has come down, and you'll see him putting on all this smiling and pointing out, well, we put the display up there, we figure more people will. As you're buying beats, you get the whole thing of what is going on. You become really wise and sharp and alert. But you're not caught by it. You're simply seeing it. Now, people who are not in this state of alertness, whenever they hear things and see things in the outward world as they're going about these things, are taken over by them, by negative remarks, for example. They hear a couple of people in the cafe booth saying something about well, it's about time for a depression again. My friend was laid off, too, and it's a small company. I may get it next. See, this is because he's asleep. We're not going to fall victim to these things anymore. One more, then we'll quit. I think we have.
On the subject of eating consciously, people insist on speaking while they're eating, and it seems to me that's one more way of avoiding being with their own thoughts. Or you can be with people and not talk, and then the feeling of companionship is there, but and the consciousness of eating. If you're eating consciously, you're aware of the taste. You're not trying to distract yourself from either your eating or the thoughts. People read while they eat, and are not at all aware of what they're eating.
Try to do, as workers, we must try to do one thing at a time. Then, bang, 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 we'll be doing one thing at a time all the time, but we'll be so fast you'll think that they're all happening, you know, at the same time, but they're really in a row, in a way. It's very complex. Remember we said that the mind alternates between a state of thinking and of consciousness. Now, you're sitting at a table with people for lunch. There's nothing the matter with being in a state of thought at time, and nothing the matter with being in a state of awareness. You may do it deliberately by assault, or you're simply, instead of talking for the moment, you're simply sitting quietly and continuing to eat. You can be conscious while you're eating, and you're simply in a different state. But then a second later, someone may ask you, I'm flying to Idaho next week. What direction is the airport, do you know? Now you have to think, because your memory says the airport to Idaho is 8 blocks west and 3 blocks south. Now you're in a state of thought, which is proper. Then a minute later, you'll be back to simply being aware. So you alternate, but either state is fine. The wrong state is to be negative all the time. See? This is not negative to be in practical thought. So now we're living very healthy and very alertly. I think we better go downstairs.